outstanding characteristic of Buddhism, delivered by Venerable Sayadaw Usilananda at the Thergatha Meditation Center on May 23, 1997.
We have been talking about things that are not so easy to understand. The law of karma, the law of dependent origination, and the law of patthana. But today, we come to some things that are not difficult to understand, and also maybe more interesting. So today, I'll talk about some outstanding characteristics of Buddhism, some important features of Buddhism. The first thing peculiar about Buddhism is that the founder of Buddhism was not God or God with capital G, or a God or a prophet or a messenger of God or a savior. But the Buddha was a human being, but not an ordinary human being, an extraordinary human being who was said to be said to have no equal. Buddha never said that he was a god or something like that. He never said he was a creator. And also he did not say that he was a human being. But we know that he was a human being because he was born of human beings, and he was born as a human being, he lived as a human being, and he died or passed away as a human being. Once he said to an ascetic he met on his way to Banaras that he was an arahant. That means he was a perfect being in the world. And he said, "I am the teacher, having no superior." That means I'm the best of the teachers. And I am the only one who has correctly known all there is to know, all by myself. And I have become cool. That means cool of passions or mental defilements, and have exhausted all mental defilements. So Buddha said he had eradicated all mental defilements, and so he was cool, he was passionless, and he knew everything there is to know, and he knew them all by himself without anybody to teach him. Although Buddha was a human being, he was more advanced in compassion and wisdom, in moral conduct than even gods. And Buddhism does not accept that there is God, the Creator. So there is no creation in Buddhism. In most religions, there is creation of the universe by a creator called God or Brahma, or by other names. But according to Buddhism, there is no creator, and so there is no creation. The the world, the inanimate world, came into being depending on the physical laws, or natural physical laws, and the animate beings came into being according to the law of karma. So the law of karma is also a natural law, and so the coming into being of the inanimate world and the animate beings both depend on natural laws, and so they don't need any agent or any creator. And the third feature is that there are no secret doctrines in Buddhism. So everything Buddha taught is open to the public for investigation or for understanding. So there is no teaching that is only for the inner circles of disciples. Once, two monks who came from high Brahmin castes asked the Buddha to record the teachings in Vedic Sanskrit language. Now, Vedic Sanskrit language is an older form of Sanskrit language, and it is very difficult. So when they requested this because they thought that Buddha's teachings were contaminated by or destroyed by all people, both because Buddha's teachings are common to both high caste people and low caste people. So they thought that when low caste people learn Buddhism, Buddha's teachings, they were destroying the teachings of the Buddha. So they wanted Buddha's teachings to be accessible only to high caste Brahmins and educated people. But Buddha rejected their request and said the words of the Buddha should not be recorded or rendered in Vedic Sanskrit language. And whoever should do so, if you do this, then for him there is an offense of wrongdoing. So there is some kind of offense if you try to record the Buddha's teachings in Vedic Sanskrit, which is not easily understood by all people. And then Buddha said, I allow you to learn the words of the Buddha each in his own dialect. So that means you can study the teachings of the Buddha in your own language. And that is what we are doing now. So we learn Buddha's teachings, I learn Buddha's teachings in Burmese, you learn in Vietnamese, and many people learn it in English. So Buddha, therefore Buddha's teachings are for all people and not for a few selected elite. In his last year, one day Buddha said to Ananda, Ananda, the teaching has been proclaimed by me without making any distinction between esoteric and exoteric. That means making any distinction between inside teachings and outside teachings, teachings for the inner circle of disciples and teachings for outside people. So Buddha did not make any such distinction. Therefore Buddha's teachings are both for those who are close to him and for those who are outside. And Buddha said, the perfect one has no such thing as the closed fist of a teacher in regard to his teachings. What is called a closed fist? That means teachers have some secret teachings, and they would not give this teaching to anybody. They would give this to their pupils who are close to them and who are very intimate with them and who are beneficial to them. So that is called a closed fist. So Buddha said, there is no such thing as closed fist regarding my teachings. So Buddha's teachings are, at one time Buddha said, the teachings are good when they are open. So there is no secrecy in the teachings of the Buddha. Now the next feature is freedom of thought and inquiry. I think Buddhism is unique among religions because Buddha allowed freedom of thought, freedom of inquiry. So we can investigate even his teachings. We have the right to doubt his teachings, but we must get rid of this doubt by study and discussion. So Buddha allows freedom of thought, and it is unheard of in the history of religions. Once Buddha visited a place of people called Kalamas. So when he was there, those people came to him and said to him, "Bhante, many religious teachers came to our place." And first one teacher would come, and then he said that only his teachings were true and others are false. And then other teachers would come, and they also said that theirs alone are correct and others, the teaching of others are wrong. So we are confused as to which is correct and which is wrong. So what must we do? Then Buddha said, "Kalamas, it is proper that you have doubt about the teachings, because many teachers have come and then told you their teaching alone is correct and others are wrong." And then Buddha said, this discourse is very important because it shows how open the Buddha was, how open to freedom of thought the Buddha's teachings are. So the Buddha said, "Do not accept anything on mere hearsay. Do not accept as correct just because you hear it from somebody. Somebody told it to you that it is correct, and that you may take it to be correct." And Buddha said, "No, do not take just by mere hearsay." And Buddha said, "Do not accept anything by mere tradition." So do not accept something to be true simply because it has been carried down through tradition, or it has been with us through tradition for a long time. And then Buddha said, "Do not accept anything on account of rumors." Sometimes people say something that it is like this or it is like that, and then rumors are mostly not correct. So do not accept anything to be true simply because it is rumored by people. And then Buddha said, "Do not accept anything to be true just because it accords with your religious books." Now, it is what we are doing, right? We will accept only that which is in accordance with our religious books. So here Buddha said, "Do not accept just because it accords with your religious books." That means you are not to be blindly accepting anything. Even though it is in accordance with your religious books, you have to investigate about it. And then Buddha said, do not accept anything by mere supposition. You think it is this way or it is that way, and you think about it, and then you think it must be true. So just by mere thinking about something, you are not to accept it to be true. Do not accept anything by mere inference. Sometimes you use inference. You infer something from some other thing, and then you arrived at the conclusion that it is true. So we always use this inference when we cannot get the direct knowledge of something. So what is arrived at by inference may or may not be true. So do not accept it to be true just because it is according to inference. Do not accept anything by merely considering the appearances. You look at something and it appears this way, and so it must be true, something like that. So you do not take it to be true just by seeing the good appearance. Something may lie beneath that appearance. So don't take it to be true just by considering the appearances. And do not accept anything merely because it accords with your preconceived notions. You may have some notions about something, and when what something said is in accordance with your preconceived notions, you jump to the conclusion that it must be true. But Buddha said, you are not to take it to be true merely because it accords with your preconceived notions. And do not accept anything merely because it seems acceptable. Sometimes we think that something is acceptable, and so we take it to be true. But Buddha said, you are not to take it to be true merely because it seems acceptable. You have to investigate it and know truly through your own observation whether it is true or not. Or do not accept anything by thinking. The ascetic is respected by us. That means I respect my teacher, and so what he said must be true. So do not take it to be true simply because you think that my teacher is a respected teacher, and so what he said must be true. You have to check with maybe other teachings. You have to check with books, and only when you find it to be conducive to well-being and happiness, are you to accept it. So Buddha was saying, do not accept anything on mere heresy and so on. So what are we to accept then? Then Buddha said, but when you know for yourselves that these things are immoral, these things are blameworthy, these things are censured by the wise, then and these things, when performed and undertaken, conduce to ruin and sorrow, then indeed do you reject them. That means you have to find out for yourself whether these things are immoral, blameworthy, censured by the wise, and are conducive to ruin and sorrow when they are practiced. And if you find it so, then you are not to accept them. So But when you know this, when you know for yourselves that these things are moral, these things are blameless, and these things are praised by the wise, and these things, when performed and undertaken, conduce to well-being and happiness, then do you live and act accordingly. So here Buddha did not say just accept it. You accept it and then you act upon it, you live it. So Buddha's advice is not just to not to accept or accept. When it is when you know this to be moral, to be blameless, to be praised by the wise, and to be conducive to well-being and happiness when practiced, then you just don't accept it, but you practice it. So Buddha's emphasis is on acting and on practice once you know something to be conducive to well-being and happiness. So by this statement and by the other statement not shown here, Buddha allowed freedom of thought or freedom of inquiry to his disciples. Next feature is self-reliance and self-responsibility. Now you know Buddha taught the law of karma. So the law of karma is good karma brings good results and bad karma brings bad results. That means if you do good karma, you will get good results, and if you do bad karma, you will get bad results. So you have to rely on yourself to get good results. And you alone are responsible for these good results or bad results. So you don't have to blame other people for the bad results you get, or actually you don't have to thank anybody for getting good results. So in Buddhism, self-reliance and self-responsibility is an important factor. Buddha wanted us to rely on ourselves and not to rely on others. It is against what we all want to do. We don't want to make effort ourselves, but we want to rely on some other person. We don't want to practice meditation if we can get the result from another person. But Buddha's teachings are against that. And Buddha declared that his teachings are going upstream, against the stream, and not going with the stream. So we have to make effort ourselves, we have to rely on ourselves for our own salvation in the Buddhist sense. Not long before he passed away, Buddha advised his disciples with these words: live with yourself as an island. Live with yourself as refuge and have no other as refuge. So take yourself to be an island, take yourself to be a refuge, and do not take any other person or any other thing as refuge. And then he continued, live with the Dhamma as your island, live with the Dhamma as your refuge, and have no other as refuge. So first Buddha said, live with yourself as an island or refuge. And to live with ourselves as an island or as refuge really means to live with Dhamma as an island or as as refuge. That means to practice Dhamma. So when we practice Dhamma, we are living with ourselves as refuge. We are relying on ourselves and not on any other. So Buddha urged his disciples to rely on themselves and to have no other as refuge. Now it might seem to be in conflict with us Buddhists taking refuge in the Bodha Dhamma and the Sangha. And we see that only those who take refuge in the Bodha, the Dhamma and the Sangha are Buddhists. Now, taking refuge in the three gems and taking oneself as refuge are two different things. Taking refuge in the three gems or taking refuge in the Buddha and so on really means recognizing or regarding the Buddha, the Dhamma and Sangha as our spiritual guides, as our teachers, not to rely on them totally and do nothing. But here, live with yourself as a refuge means you rely on yourself, you make effort yourself so that you get the results of the practice. And nobody can give results of the practice to you. So you must do it yourself, you must make effort yourself so that you get the results. So these two statements, say to take refuge in the three gems and to take oneself as refuge, are two different things. Buddha said in the Dhammavada, oneself indeed is one savior, for who other should be the savior? So that means you alone can save yourself and nobody can save you. This is very important. So our desire is to be saved by the Buddha. But Buddha was saying, you alone is your savior. That means I am not your savior. I cannot save you. You must save yourself. Now why did Buddha say this? You must save yourself, and there is no other who can save you. Because saving oneself means getting rid of mental defilements. And to get rid of your mental defilements, you must practice. Nobody can get into your mind and take those mental defilements away. So if that could be done, it would be very good for us. We don't need to practice. We just go to a teacher and let him take the mental defilements out of our minds. And that is impossible. So Buddha said, in effect, I cannot save you, you must save yourself. Because only we can save ourselves. Only we can do something to get to rid our minds of mental defilements, and no other person can do it for us. There are people who criticize Buddhism, saying, why cannot Buddha save you if he is compassionate, if he possesses great compassion? Buddha was a person who possessed what is called great compassion. That means Buddha had compassion for all beings without exception. But here Buddha said, Buddha did not save beings simply because it was impossible to save other beings. If it were possible for Buddhas to save beings, then Buddha would have saved all beings, because the very purpose of making inspiration for Buddhahood and trying to become a Buddha is to save beings. But here we must understand saving in a Buddhist sense, and that is helping beings to save themselves. And Buddha said, with oneself well controlled, one obtains a savior difficult to find. So if you want to get a savior who is difficult to find, you just control yourself. You control your senses. So when your senses or faculties are controlled, then you have found a savior who is difficult to find. That means you have become your own savior. And in another verse, Buddha said, by oneself alone evil is done, by oneself is one defiled. By oneself is evil left undone, by oneself indeed is one purified. So, evil or akusala is done by oneself. And so, oneself is defiled, one is defiled by oneself. So we defile ourselves when we do evil. And by oneself is evil left undone. So when we abstain from doing evil, doing akusala, then by oneself is one purified. We purify ourselves. So defiling and purifying depends on ourselves. We can defile ourselves or we can purify ourselves. So we cannot defile another person or purify another person. So Buddha said, purity and impurity depend on oneself. No one purifies another. So this we must keep it in mind. Purity and impurity depend on oneself. So we can make ourselves pure or impure. No one purifies another. So no one can purify another person. That means no one can purify another person's mind of mental defilements. Now the next feature is that caste is not recognized in Buddhism. Now Buddhism or Buddha appeared in a society where human beings are divided into four castes. And they are very rigidly defined and intermarriage or interrelation between castes are discouraged. And this caste system has done a lot of suffering to people. But Buddha did not accept this caste system. Although we cannot say that Buddha abolished caste system in India, because he could not, although he wanted to. So we cannot say that Buddha did not Buddha abolished caste system in India, but he suddenly abolished caste system among his own disciples. Anybody who joined the order of monks left his caste behind and began a new life as one above the caste system. That means everybody who becomes a monk is just a monk. And he loses his caste. He is no longer a warrior caste or a Brahmin or a merchant or a low caste person. He is just a monk. So among his disciples, especially monks, Buddha was able to abolish caste distinction. So anybody who joins the order becomes equal with other monks. There is a story of Sakyan princess and their brother, who became monks. So they wanted to go forth. They wanted to become monks, and so they went to the Buddha, and then they asked the Buddha to ordain the Berber first and to ordain them later, because in the dispensation, those who are ordained first are senior to those who are ordained later, regardless of their age. So the Sakyan princess said to the Buddha, Bhante, Buddha also belonged to the Sakyan race. So they said, Bhante, we Sakyan people are very proud. So in order to get rid of this pride in ourselves, let our Baba, the hairdresser, become a monk first, and let us pay respects to him. And so let him ordain first. So Buddha ordained first the Baba, and then later the Sakyan princess. And you know who that Baba was? Yeah? He was the Venerable Upali, who was appointed the best among those who know Vinaya, and who was the one who reported all the Vinaya Pitaka to the assembly, to the first Buddhist council. So Upali became a very prominent person among the disciples of the Buddha. But he was a Baba. A Baba is said to be, they're said to belong to a very low caste. One of the wonderful things of the Buddha's dispensation is that those who became monks in the Dhamma and discipline of the Buddha become equal. They lose their names and clans, they lose their caste, and they are just monks or recluses in the dispensation of the Buddha. In this respect, the Buddha's dispensation was compared to the great ocean. So many rivers, many different rivers flow into the great ocean. So before they reach the ocean, they retain their own names like the Ganges, Yamuna, and so on. But once they reach the ocean, they lose their names and they are just a body of water, they are just a great ocean. So Buddha said, in the same way, people before joining the order may belong to warrior caste or Brahmin caste or merchant caste and low caste, but once they join the order, they lose their own names and clans. That means they lose their own castes, and they are reckoned simply as recluses, as monks, as sons of the son of the Sakya, that means son of the Buddha. So this is said to be the fourth strange, wonderful thing in the Dhamma and discipline of the Buddha. Now there are eight wonderful things in the sasana, and this is the fourth. According to the Buddha, one becomes an outcast or a Brahmin, not by birth, but by one's own karma. So if one does wholesome karma, then he is as good as a Brahmin. And one, if one does akusala, then he is an outcast, whether he was born as a Brahmin or not. So what determines a person to be low or high is not his birth, but his deeds. So in the teachings of the Buddha, the deeds or karma, the deeds are an important factor in determining a person to be a lowly person or a high person. And the other feature of Buddhism is that in Buddhism, women are not downtrodden. Women are not suppressed. Women are considered capable of enlightenment, as men are. So, in the teachings of the Buddha, women has as much right to enlightenment as men. Not because you are a woman or a man can you attain enlightenment or not. So whether you are a man or a woman, if you follow the teachings of the Buddha and practice, then you can become enlightened. So women are regarded as equally capable of enlightenment as men are. And also in the dispensation of the Buddha, women attained honored positions as the best among people in different capabilities. Now there, during the time of the Buddha, among monks, there were the Venerable Sariputta and Moggallana. They were foremost among, Sariputta was foremost among those who possessed wisdom, and Moggallana was foremost among those who possessed, what do you call, Iddhi. Also among nuns, there were Khema and Uplawana, who are respectively foremost among those who possessed wisdom and who possessed Iddhi. So, women were given an honorary place in the teachings of the Buddha. Before the time of the Buddha, in India, women are in a very bad position, very low position. But in the teachings of the Buddha, in this dispensation of the Buddha, women are mostly almost like men. People respect them, and people sought advice from them, and so they have, I think, the same opportunity as men to practice what the Buddha taught and to reach the perfect stage as arahants. When Mahabhajavadi Gautami, Buddha's foster mother, requested the Buddha to admit her and other women to the Sangha, to the order, Buddha refused 3 times. Then Ananda met Mahabhajavadi Gautami, and he knew about the refusal of the Buddha, and so he pleaded to the Buddha for Mahabhajavadi Gautami, and again Buddha refused. So Ananda put this question to the Buddha, Bande, a woman having gone forth from home to homelessness in the Dhamma and discipline proclaimed by the Tathagata, that means in this asana, able to realize the fruit of stream attainment or the fruit of one's returning or the fruit of non-returning or perfection. That means if a woman renounces the world and becomes a nun, able to attain or able to become enlightened, then the answer Buddha gave was in the affirmative. Buddha said, yes, women are capable to become enlightened as sotapannas and so on. So when Buddha said that, Ananda said, then why not give permission to your foster mother? She was beneficial to you. She nursed you personally while she gave her own son to the other nurses and so on. And so in the end, Buddha gave the permission for women to enter the order. If you read the Vinaya rules for both monks and nuns, you may want to see that there is some kind of discrimination. I think we must admit that there is a kind of discrimination, but I don't want to say against women. Discrimination for the disciples, because I think it was necessary to make some provisions for their safety as well as for the purity of the dispensation and also for the growth of the dispensation. So in that case, there have to be some rules, say restricting women from doing this or that. And in that case, we may say that there is a kind of discrimination. But in the field of practice and attainment, there is no discrimination. Women are as capable as men in achieving attainment of enlightenment. Even some women are better than men, or some men may be better than women. So with regard to the practice and with regard to attainment, there is no discrimination. Now you have heard the story of a woman who practiced meditation following the teaching given by some 30 monks, and then she became enlightened before those 30 monks, right? So the monks who taught her how to meditate were left behind, and she became she reached the third stage, not the first and second, but she even reached the third stage of enlightenment before the monks reached any attainment at all. So there is no saying that because you are a woman you cannot reach attainment, or because you are a man you are more favorable to get attainment. So there is no such thing in Buddhism. And then the next feature is tolerance. Now, tolerance in Buddhism is not only for human beings, but for animals as well. And also tolerance taught in Buddhism is far superior to that taught in, say, the other teachings. Now, Buddha once said to monks, even if bandits were to sever you savagely limb by limb with a two-handled saw. He who corrupts his mind with hate would on that account be not the one who carried out my teaching. So even if the enemies are cutting you with the two-handled saw, if you are angry with them, you are not the one who follow my advice. So it is, I think it's very difficult to follow this advice. even though enemies are cutting you, you are not to have a hate towards them. So in Buddhism, tolerance is carried to the utmost. And also in Buddhism, tolerance is to be extended towards animals also. So the first precept for lay people is abstention from killing living beings. So here, abstention from killing not only human beings, but all living beings. So Buddhist tolerance is not for human beings only, but for all living beings. The Buddha was not in favor of sacrifices where many human beings and animals were killed. Buddha actually prevented many such sacrifices during his time. So Buddhist tolerance or kindness is both for human beings and animals. I hope you know the Emperor Asoka of ancient India. So before he became a Buddhist, he was a warlord. He conquered many countries, and in one battle called Battle of Kalinga, it is stated that many thousands of people were killed. Later he became a Buddhist. And after he became a Buddhist, he gave up war for conquest. So from that time on, his conquest was by Dhamma. So he had many edicts to be written and put up in different places of the country, and even now many of them were found and read and understood. So in one of his pillar edicts, he said, "The gift of spiritual insight too has been bestowed by me upon men in various ways, and for two-footed and four-footed beings, for birds and denizens of waters, I have ordained manifold kindness up to the boon of life." That means sparing the lives of two-footed animals, four-footed animals, birds, and then animals in the water. So after he became a Buddhist, he gave up war, and he tried himself to be kind to all beings, and also he set up these rock edicts and pillar edicts for his countrymen to follow his example. Another feature I want you to be aware of is that there has been no religious persecution in the history of Buddhism. We do not find any Buddhists or any Buddhist nation persecuting fellow Buddhists or people of other religion. Buddhists are always taught to be tolerant, and so Actually, it was the Buddhists who were persecuted in ancient India, persecuted by Hindus and persecuted by Muslims. So it is also an important feature that there was no persecution or religious persecution in history of Buddhism. So there are many more features of Buddhism which are worthy of note, but I think we have got enough features of enough outstanding features of Buddhism to understand. So I think we are lucky to be Buddhist or to be the followers of the Buddha. And as Buddhists, we are free to inquire, we are free to doubt, we are free to investigate. And as Buddhists, we are masters of ourselves. We are the architect of our own future. And we are those who rely on ourselves for our own good. And so Buddhists can become responsible and good citizens who will contribute to the welfare of the human society, as well as who do whatever they can for their own benefit, which is the avoidance of unwholesome karma and getting rid of mental defilements.